Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that can't escape the grip of the two main parties. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
This midweek shot, we're going to have a look at the smaller parties in British politics. We talked in our last episode about how Britain, since Brexit, has been polarised. The election led to a massive return of two-party politics. And the polls haven't really moved since the election, have they, Steve?
No, pretty much all of the polls have shown Labour and the Conservatives neck and neck, both on around about 40% each. Some polls have Labour ahead by 1 or 2 points. I think the biggest I've seen was a 3-point lead. Mm. Some have it the other way around, with the Tories ahead by 1 or 2 points, and again, 1 or 2 with a 3-point lead.
And no third party's been able to break through that. And after a couple of weeks in which yet another centre party has been launched and UKIP are looking for yet another leader, we ask, can any third party break into the mainstream? Let's start with UKIP, Steve, mainly because it's really, really funny. Henry Bolton, those of you who listened to the Not Enough Champagne end of year quiz in 2017 will know my favourite fact about Henry Bolton is that he received more votes as a Lib Dem PPC standing against Philip Hammond than he received for UKIP leader. He left his wife in December for Jo Marnie, who I think is some sort of model who's 20 years his junior. Now, Jo Marnie sent some texts to a friend, which was very unwise, and the friend leaked them to the Daily Mail. And
some friend.
Yeah, indeed. There's no friends in UKIP politics, Steve.
Really?
This was after Meghan Markle was engaged to Prince Harry, and Jo Marnie said that Meghan Markle's seed will taint the royal family.
Yeah, and I think that's where we'll leave it off in terms of repeating some of the things she said because they weren't very pleasant.
And it's weird. She seems to be confusing Meghan Markle with a tree. Lots of bad stuff, and that meant that there were lots of mass resignations in UKIP, and there was a vote of no confidence in Henry Bolton. And Henry Bolton refused to stand down.
Each of the different steps in this story, it is absolutely ridiculous. Like, you could not write an episode of The Thick of It with as many plot twists and turns as UKIP have managed to create as part of this political crisis of theirs.
And the upshot of it is that actually the membership did go against Bolton. The vote of no confidence was upheld. So Bolton resigned the leadership and apparently has left the party now as well. And therefore, he's now back with Jo Marnie after saying that the romantic side of the relationship was no longer happening after the racist stuff came out.
Turns out he might have been lying there, listeners.
UKIP has a new interim leader. I think it's Gerald Batten, though. Yeah. By the time this episode comes out, could be a different interim leader. So in 2015, UKIP got a good 10% of the vote countrywide. They got about 4 million votes. So a couple of questions, I suppose, kind of related. What happens to UKIP now? Are they just a busted flush? And more generally, what happens in terms of the far right in British politics? Because there's, from the British Union of Fascists, the National Front, the BNP, there's always been a kind of far right fringe group in British politics. Is it now, is Britain First going to rise up? Will it be something from Aaron Banks? Like, what happens to that grouping?
Okay, so I think it's safe to say that UKIP's fox has well and truly been shot. There is very little there to salvage. Nigel Farage came out in favour of Henry Bolton maintaining the leadership of UKIP. And one of the points he made was that the UKIP National Executive wasn't fit for purpose. And that was one of the reforms that Bolton was trying to push through, was basically scrapping the current National Executive, moving more powers into the leadership position and creating some new form of body to run the party. For whatever reason, The people on the UKIP National Executive appear to be a bit loopy and are focused very much on just achieving their internal battles rather than trying to grow the party as a whole.
I can't imagine what that looks like.
No, it's not like any of the political parties ever have that problem at all. As a result of that, and the result of this infighting, which seems to be going on, UKIP's hemorrhaged votes, hemorrhaged members, and, you know, they've lost their raison d'etre. They don't, like, Brexit is happening. You know, there's no reason for them really to exist anymore, which means there is a complete absence currently of a receptacle for that far-right vote in UK politics. Now, that's not to say everybody who voted for UKIP are, you know, secretly Nazis. People vote for lots of different reasons. But certainly there was a definite element of that amongst their support and amongst some of their members. Those people are going to try and find a new home. So you mentioned Britain First and Aaron Banks. Aaron Banks being one of the bigwigs who was funding the Leave campaign and was at one point a, I don't know if he still is, a UKIP donor. But I suspect Britain First do run for elections, or at least people associated with it do. One of them ran for Mayor of London and famously turned their back on the results when Sadiq Khan was announced as the winner. Lovely folks that they are over there. I suspect what you'll probably will find, though, is that Aaron Banks is going to move and try and form a new party in some description. What that looks like, I don't really know. Banks's views and opinions seem to flail wildly from one side to the other in a number of areas. He's the sort of person who would absolutely go for a more kind of libertarian messaging. But at the same time, he's also quite authoritarian in a number of areas as well, which would just create the same kind of problem that UKIP currently has, or rather that UKIP had, of very different members with not even a shared ambition of where they want Britain to go, other than, you know, getting out of the EU. So Banks would be the likely person to fund a new outfit or a new party. The problem is, who's going to be in it? Who's going to run it? Who would lead it? Now, you know, the first person that always springs to mind in these sorts of things is Nigel Farage, but I don't think Farage wants to be in charge of anything anymore. If he wanted that, he could go swanning back to UKIP. You know, he'd be guaranteed to get airplay. He gets it now, even though he's not a representative, technically, of UKIP anymore.
I think that's just because the BBC are trolling Andrew Adonis, to be fair.
Quite possibly, yes. Mm.
One reason that UKIP did very badly is that lack of a leader. Paul Nuttall was rubbish in the election, which didn't help. And you need that sort of front figure. I think the other reason that UKIP didn't do very well is essentially the Tories stole their positions on a lot of issues. Mm-hmm. So Theresa May on grammar schools, on hard Brexit, with a citizens of nowhere rhetoric, regardless of what Nick Timothy says, like, that's the rhetoric that was coming across. That kind of talk stole UKIP's clothes. Mm-hmm. And I think actually that leads us on to the Green Party, because the Greens, again, are a party that didn't do very well in the election. I suspect partly because a Corbynite Labour Party in many ways steals a lot of the Greens' clothes. Actually, one of the more interesting articles I read over the past week or so was an Owen Jones article suggesting that the Greens could merge with the Labour Party in a similar way that the Cooperative Party do. So the idea would be, like, you can have Labour and Co-op parties now, you have Labour and Green MPs. And that would be a way of bringing people like Caroline Lucas into the Labour fold to potentially be part of the shadow cabinet or a subsequent Labour cabinet. It stops the splitting of the left-wing vote, which is a problem under our rubbish electoral system. And as a supporter of a progressive alliance and parties working together, I have a lot of sympathy with the view. I'm not sure what the view is in the Greens. I imagine they'd want to try and keep their independence. And I also think that Greens are more likely to try and campaign for electoral reform. I think it's not a position. I don't think that's something that's going to happen now. I think it's something that might happen in the future, given that I don't think we're going to see electoral reform for many, many years.
Mm-hmm. With those kind of suggestions, you need to kind of cut back right to the basics and ask, what is the purpose of a third party in a two-party first-past-the-post system? Now, obviously, the purpose of any political party is to try and win seats, win power, and enact change, of bring about their agenda in some form. Given it's very difficult under our system for smaller parties to win seats, the only way that they can really make a difference is by changing the terms of the debate. You know, moving that Overton window, making certain policy points, and making them mainstream. And you can see that with the Greens, you've seen it with the Lib Dems in some areas as well, and you can see it with UKIP. if you take that as a kind of a notion that you need to influence the main parties who are going to be in government, then certainly there is a strong case to be made for, you know, maybe officially joining up with Labour in some capacity. For the Greens especially, that could actually be very good for them, I feel, because if you did end up with Labour-Green tickets, in effect, that would give the Greens an internal power base within Labour. And if they've got that power base within Labour, it means they can then utilise that to push forward more radical policies on environmentalism or whatever else it is that they want to focus on, which would lead almost certainly to, when you do eventually get a Labour government under whoever, probably a more radically green manifesto than it otherwise would have been. So for the Greens, I think that would make sense. Arguably for UKIP, that's probably something, or whatever UKIP's successor is, you know, attaching to the Tories in that kind of way would also make sense, I feel. Whatever their issues is, probably immigration. The problem for the Lib Dems, though, is that there's nowhere really for them to team up with. They're not going to go for the try and work with the Tories, because they've done that. It got them, you know, eviscerated at the 2015 election. And actually, Labour don't actually share that many policies other than we would like to be nice and cuddly to everybody with the Lib Dems. I'd say they need to try and forge out a path which is going to have to be distinct. It's going to have to be radical in some capacity. And it is probably actually, as much as we tend to lambast this term and the types of people who go after this approach, probably is going to have to be populist in some manner. Because unless you're talking about things that people are really going to support, you're never going to be able to break through in a two-party system. Now, what things the Lib Dems could be populist about? I mean, that's a tough question to ask and get an answer to.
I mean, one potentially is cannabis legalisation and or decriminalisation. That was one of the flagship policies that certainly that cut through in the office in which I was working during the general election. Comments weren't made about Tim Farron and gay sex. Instead, it was, oh, well, the Lib Dems proposed this policy. Now, it wasn't done in a very complimentary way, but it did cut through, and that could be a bit of a wedge issue, maybe.
Potentially, yeah. I mean, and it would certainly be something that, you know, most Lib Dem members and most current Lib Dem voters could get behind in some capacity. And certainly their target demographics that they'd want to go after would probably be very open to that kind of policy. But the problem is that's one thing. Mm. Now, it may very well be what you'll find is that the Lib Dems could go hard on this kind of policy, and then eventually what will happen is Labour will just pick it up. And again, that undermines their ability to kind of get engaged. And again, brings you back to that, well, wouldn't they have just been better to associate with Labour in that instance? But the Lib Dems are never going to do that. The Lib Dems, unlike the Greens, I'm sure there are a number of Greens who would radically disagree with me on this, the Greens do not have the same kind of rich political history in the UK that the Lib Dems do. The Lib Dems come, yes, they are a merger of the SDP and the Liberals, but they can trace their lineage back way, way, way back into the 18th, 17th century.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose Gladstone, Keynes, Lloyd George, Beveridge, like there's a rich history there.
Yeah, of political impact and change brought about by liberals within Britain. They're rightly proud of that. As a reforming Liberal Democrat, you know, I get it. I do. Most of the people don't care. That's the problem. So just because you are sat there kind of going, no, I am different because of these obscure differences of opinion, most of the people are just going to see you as exactly the same. Therefore, why would I vote for the smaller guy when I can vote for the bigger guy who's actually going to win?
And that's been the problem with the Lib Dem positioning on Brexit, I think. If you wanted to stop a hard Brexit in June, you voted tactically for Labour, even if you were sympathetic to the Lib Dem position on Brexit. And I still think in a subsequent election, that's probably still the case. I think the other problem a third party's got is trying to work out where to target the seats. Mm-hmm. And the problem we discussed a bit on our Lib Dem episode over the summer is that they're not really a national party anymore. You look at some of the vote totals that they got in seats, but they were winning in 2010 or finishing second in 2010. And they're nowhere. They're losing deposits. And that's a real massive problem for them. They became successful because of the strategy of Chris Rennard, of target seats and picking target seats and sticking to them. That is the way the third party breaks through a two-party system. Problem is, it's really, really hard to know where those seats are. It's also really hard for the Greens. I mean, the Greens' main target seat, apart from Brighton in the election where Caroline Lucas is, their main target seat was in Bristol with Thangam Debonair, a Labour seat. Well, Thangam Debonair ended up with a majority of about 35,000. So again, how do you break into a two-party system in such a polarised electorate? I think it's really, really hard.
Yeah, no, it is. I just kind of want to take the two things you talked about there as separate points. So firstly, when you're talking about the Lib Dems and Brexit, there's been some polling recently which has shown that the majority of people in the country do not know what the Lib Dems' position on Brexit is.
You're joking.
No, not at all. They do not know that, like, arguably, the Lib Dems are the only party with a solidly anti-Brexit line. They have been the ones who have actually been pushing the hardest for, you know, a second vote to try and undo Brexit. You know, they've got, you know, Nick Clegg, the former Deputy Prime Minister, was there, was the spokesperson for Brexit and was getting lots of airtime talking about these things. And yet that message has not cut through at all. That's probably one of the reasons they're suffering, is that people just aren't paying attention and they don't care.
I suppose part of that is a lack of airtime at things like Prime Minister's Questions and Question Time, in that in the Kennedy years and the Ashdown years, you always have a slot every week because you're that third party. Actually, Vince Cable hasn't even been turning up to some of the Prime Minister's Questions recently.
I was about to say, you know, I've never been a massive fan of Tim Farron, but Tim Farron actually turned up to PMQs every week. He'd stand up, he'd put in his questions, he'd make sure he was there. And, you know, you'd often get comments from journalists on Twitter and in the media saying, well, Tim Farron's been ignored again, Tim Farron's finally gotten a question. You know, he was at least a part of the debate. Cable can't even be bothered to turn up because he views it as a waste of time. Now, it may very well be a waste of time, but you're the leader of a goddamn political party in Westminster, and PMQs is your one opportunity in the week to ask a question to the Prime Minister and put your agenda in front of them, and you're not even bothering.
It's also the problem of not being able to go on Question Time as well. I mean, we hinted earlier at the fact that Nigel Farage has been on 8,000 Question Time appearances.
I believe it's 34 in the past couple of years.
Cracky. It's almost a mystery as why I stopped watching it. If there is no Lib Dem presence, then again that view gets marginalised and ignored, and it's really hard, I think, to get it back.
Yeah. On the second kind of point we were discussing about that kind of that geographic or of where the hell do you target to win a seat, really, and I think this goes for the Greens and it goes for the Lib Dems as well. And for the Lib Dems, there actually are people in their party who have identified this. What they need to do is build out a core vote of demographics. So it's, you know, Mark Pack.
Hello, Mark, if you're listening.
Yeah, done some work with, I believe it's David Rendell. Little 15, 20 page document, which is talking about how to build up a 25% core vote for the Lib Dems. I can't remember the exact details, but it basically boils down to, you know, left-wing internationalists. When you take a look at things demographically, you are then able to identify seats like in London, for instance. Bit tricky because London is a Labour city rather than a rural area where you can go up against the Tories, but there are seats where you will be able to say, this is where we should be hitting. It's very different to what the Lib Dems were doing previously, given that it means they're hitting more inner city seats. It means they're hitting urban areas like Birmingham, Manchester, Leeds a lot harder than they were previously, because a lot of their effort in the past was in rural areas where it was them or the Tories. The Lib Dems are having that discussion. The Greens will probably be having that discussion in some capacity as well. The issue is, and you said this before, how the hell do you break through in a polarised environment? Because using the Lib Dems as an example, if your main kind of target is like left-wing internationalists or kind of left-leaning internationalists, why would I vote Lib Dem now versus Labour?
I'll tell you who you should vote for instead, Steve. You should vote for a new centre party. Another one got launched on Friday. It's called Renew. It's taken its inspiration from Emmanuel Macron.
How many are we at now?
I think it's neck and neck with the amount of UKIP leaders we've had over the past couple of years. I think it's probably about 8 or 9. Renew happened. They want ordinary people to join and become candidates. And I think they've had something like 3,000 members join and 300 candidates would-be candidates come and stand up. Now, if that sounds familiar, listeners, that's because it is. That was Democracy 2015 that Andreas Whittam Smith, who I think was the founding editor of The Independent, he launched that 6 or 7 years ago. And the idea was you get ordinary people who are not involved in politics to stand. And remind me, Steve, how many MPs did Democracy 2015 actually get?
Well, I'm going to take a stab and say that's a big fat zero.
It was a big fat zero. And I completely understand the want to set up a new centre party. And it's certainly a symptom of the fact that we are in a two-party system where the parties are quite polarised and there's lots of people who feel quite homeless politically. And as a recovering Liz Kendall voter, I can have a certain amount of sympathy for that. However, you do not change that by starting a new party which is not going to get many votes and get nowhere. You could campaign to change the voting system. If you want to be an ordinary person and stand for a candidate, then join one of the other main parties up. But just having a party to represent the centre ground doesn't make sense. And I think one of the main reasons is because political parties don't represent ideas, they represent interests. So with Labour, the interest is the trade union movement. It's the working classes. With the Conservatives, it's the boss class. It's the industry class. Now, that's broadly speaking. That's massive brushstrokes. But there are interests there with movements and donors who have mass broad appeal. Now, that is not the case for though these new centre parties, which are established, whose main issue essentially is to stop Brexit. Well, maybe they're one of the 48% who didn't realise that the Lib Dems were an anti-Brexit party, but I don't see it working.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest issue I have with every single time we get one of these, a new centrist party has been formed, alerts, is that they always go, and yes, we want to emulate Emmanuel Macron and En Marche, and I'm like, the reason En Marche worked for the Emmanuel Macron was because they had Emmanuel Macron. They had this a leader. They had a politician who was reasonably actually well known. Bear in mind, he did not come out from nowhere. He was a former prime minister.
He was chancellor.
Yeah, exactly. He was a major figure in a government. So people knew who he was, which means that he was given a lot more authority and gravitas than, you know, some random sod who just happened to form a new party anyway. And he is charismatic. He does have a vision. You may not like it, you may disagree with it, or disagree with parts of it and agree with parts of it, but he has a notion of what he wants France to look like. And that is something that is totally missing from pretty much anybody, and I mean this across all political parties, who says we need a new centrist kind of hub, we need a new centrist party or whatever. You need that leader who can inspire, and you absolutely need a vision about what it is you're trying to do. So yeah, it is partially about interests, but I would argue it's more about actually knowing what it is you're trying to achieve. Because, oh, we just want to stop Brexit, that's not going to make people vote for you. You know, you need to be able to say, you know, just off the top of my head, we want a country which is like Sweden. Yeah, or one of the Scandinavian Nordic states. That's what we're aspiring to. And this is how we're different to the Tories, and this is how we're different to the Lib Dems, and this is how we're different to Labour. The problem is you can't do that, because all of the traditions within Labour and the Tories, you can find a home in one of them if you are a centrist. There is a reason that Anna Salisbury joined the Tories in the first place. There's a reason George Osborne joined the Tories in the first place. Likewise, there's a reason Liz Kendall joined Labour. The same with Tony Blair. Like, just because you're a centrist doesn't mean you're actually radically different in terms of what you're trying to achieve compared to your more extreme comrades or colleagues and within your party. What often is the case, it's just the manner in which you want to get there.
There is an interesting counterfactual in which Labour gets thumped in the June 2017 general election and Chuka Amana launches a new party with people like Tim Farron and Anna Salisbury. Like, that could have happened, but it didn't happen.
Yeah, and that would have been the situation where actually that could have succeeded. because you would have had known figures. You would have had somebody who actually does have charisma. You know, I will critique Chukwuma Umeda on an awful lot of things. I do not think he's as good as a lot of people have painted him out to be, but he is a charismatic individual. And if Labour had taken a hiding and Corbyn had refused to stand down, which was widely being talked about at mm-hmm. the time, it might have worked.
But that moment has passed for now.
Yeah.
Again, just to wrap this up, the impression I get with both main, and again, this is probably a different podcast, but both main parties, they've got broad voting coalitions at the moment, but I think the support is broad and shallow. Maybe in the medium term, there is a opportunity for a third party, but at the moment, it's not going to happen. I think the stasis will continue until something gives. Now, it needs to be a big event. It needs to be Britain crashing out of the EU without a deal or something massive like that. But it's not, I don't think, going to happen this side of a general election.
No, I don't think it is either, unless something really bizarre does occur. I can't see there being any breakthrough of any third political party between now and the next general election.
On that happy note of optimism.
It is a happy note of optimism if you're Labour or the Tories.
Yes, that's true. We have a Friday Fizz coming out on Friday. We'll probably be trying to work out what the hell Labour's Brexit position is since Jeremy Corbyn's speech, which hasn't happened at the time that we're recording. We have stuff coming out on our Facebook page, facebook.com/notenoughchampagne, and our Twitter handle is @nochampagnepod. My Twitter handle is paperbackwriter.
Mine's centre radical.
Happy plotting, everyone.